Welcome to Hammer and Tongs.
This is a left-wing show that tries to take a longer view of the world with less emphasis on immediate headlines. And today we're going to be talking about police in movies and television in the United States throughout the past few decades. And with us is Alex Vitale again, who is the author of multiple books about police and policing in the United States. Most recently, his book, The End of Policing, has been translated into several languages, Portuguese being the latest, I think. So, without further ado, let's talk about movies and let's talk about cops. So 100 years ago, we had movies featuring Charlie Chaplin and the Keystone Cops, where audiences actually cheered when the quote-unquote bad guy got away from the police. How do we get from that to now, where you have just a slew of television shows in which the police can do no wrong, the bad guys are always completely evil, and they just serve as what you call copaganda? How did that change happen?
So, you know, 100 years or so ago, when you get these early film portrayals of policing, there's a broad sense in the community that policing is corrupt, it's ineffective, and it has a class bias. So what you see in Charlie Chaplin and Keystone Cops is often a kind of class conflict, right, where the down and out person is being subjected to abusive, discriminatory, class war-based policing. And the audience, I think, is very sympathetic to an anti-police analysis. And this is the kind of crisis of confidence of policing during that era that leads to the progressive era reforms of the 19 teens and 20s, kind of coming out of World War I. And basically what we have is a long period of so-called police professionalization, which is this effort to create civil service exams, more training to try to root out some of the worst corruption and incompetency.
So just to reiterate your point, so basically previous to those progressive era reforms, there weren't examinations to be a police officer. There weren't.
That's right. Yeah. So police were political appointments, essentially, and this was often tied to patronage politics. So local elected officials would appoint local police officers based on, you know, whether or not they'd help get the vote out. And also, you know, the function of policing was tied to that patronage politics, so that if the local ward leader was close with local manufacturers, it would be very easy to get the police to turn out to suppress not just strike activity, but even meetings or public speeches, you know, that were pro-union would be immediately and often violently suppressed by local police. And so by the early 1960s, right, you begin to have the race riots, the rebellions, and this creates a new level of crisis for policing. And the response to that is to bring back this discourse around professionalization, but to add on top of it this very high level of copaganda. And so beginning with Dragnet, but really with shows like Adam 12 and Mod Squad, which both begin in the late 60s in the wake of the Watts riots, is this effort to reestablish police legitimacy. And out of that comes a series of television shows that are either co-produced with police, like Adam 12, or are actively engaged in a kind of rehabilitation of policing, shows like Mod Squad, both of which begin in 1967. And they take a kind of two different approaches to this re-legitimation process. Adam 12, a kind of procedural drama, which was produced by Jack Webb, who had created Dragnet and starred in Dragnet. They work with the LAPD, go through case files and construct these stories about the life of a patrol officer. And the message of that series is one of intense professionalization, right? We just enforce the law. We're neutral. We're not racist. We care about the public's well-being. And this is a direct effort to kind of reestablish this idea, or really just establish, because it was never that well established, that the LAPD is here to protect and serve you, as opposed to the experience that many people in Los Angeles, especially people of color, had, which was the LAPD was a source of violence and discrimination. Now, Mod Squad takes a different tact. Rather than focusing on professionalization, they focus more on diversity and kind of community embeddedness. So in Mod Squad, instead of the clean-cut uniformed officer, patrol officers, what you have is young people, a woman, a Black person, a young white guy, who've been pressured into becoming police sort of cooperators, informants, and police officers because they've been involved in drugs or some kind of trouble. And then the police are using them to infiltrate drug gangs and violent extremists and all the rest.
And each of those characters is a sort of archetype of the time of youth slash counterculture. We have the angry Black radical. We've got the young white radical, the guy. And then we have the hippie girl runaway from San Francisco.
Counterculture.
So we've got the three kind of like archetypes of what were seen to be shaking the system at the time.
That's right. And so all three of them are turned on their head to become part of the police apparatus. And the message of the show is that there are a lot of dangerous people in these counterculture and political underworlds. And we need to use policing to, protect people. And if we make our policing more diverse, more community-centered, more connected to the communities we're trying to protect, that this will make policing better. And it erases the actual history of policing in brutally suppressing those movements.
So those shows come out in the late 1960s and they continue on into the 70s. But in the 1970s, we also start to see some new personifications, some new archetypes of police in United States culture. And one of those is the rogue cop. And the exemplar of this is Dirty Harry, the cop that plays by his own rules, the cop that's often at war with the rules of his own department. This is when we start to see the image of the cop who's always arguing with his superiors, with the sergeant, with the lieutenant. And what is he arguing about? He's saying there's too many rules. You've put too many rules on me. You've handcuffed the cops. I can't do my job. I can't fight crime because there's too many rules. And this argument echoes the logic that is being developed at the same time about why the United States is losing the Vietnam War. The politicians in Washington are making us fight with one hand tied behind our back. Otherwise, we would have won this thing already. And there's many examples of this rogue cop idea that spring up. There's Starsky and Hutch, the TV show. And when Saturday Night Live parodied Starsky and Hutch, they called the sketch Police State, because that is in effect what is being argued for by this kind of rogue cop idea, as a cop who needs to have no rules that they abide by. You were saying, Alex, that some of this is a reaction to the court cases Miranda versus Arizona and Mapp versus Ohio. Miranda versus Arizona is, of course, what gives us the Miranda rights. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to a lawyer, etc. And Mapp v. Ohio is the ruling that said that evidence was inadmissible in court if it was obtained illegally. In other words, the police have to use search warrants. And both the Miranda decision and the Mapp v. Ohio decision both come down in the 1960s. And you were talking about how this rogue cop idea is a reaction, in a way, to those decisions and others.
So, you know, the most extreme, you know, authoritarian thin blue line forces, you know, were always opposed to those liberal rulings by the Warren Court. But during the 1960s, there was this real need to deal with the legitimacy crisis that was causing the explosion of American cities and you know, armed resistance against police in the state. By the 1970s, though, these movements had been pretty successfully suppressed. Black Panthers have been executed. More radical elements have been criminalized or killed. And so by the 1970s, we see a full-scale right-wing backlash that uses discourse about crime and the primacy of policing to reestablish the idea that the problems of American society are not rooted in capitalism, racism, you know, the coming neoliberal austerity. No, the problems of America are problems of moral insufficiency, social breakdown, and the way we solve those problems is ever more intensive and invasive policing. And anyone who wants to, quote, handcuff the police is inviting crime and disorder. And so you get this new narrative that is a kind of vigilante justice narrative that's not just in police shows, but also in the kind of, you know, community violence, the death wish kind of things of people taking the law into their own hands because the police are too handcuffed to deal with the bad guys. And this leads to, you know, a really horrible set of narratives that contribute directly to the embracing of mass incarceration by the 1980s.
I wanted to quote from an excellent movie, A Touch of Evil by Orson Welles. Now, that's from 1958. So this is before when we're talking about, but a quote that always stuck with me, where a corrupt cop says to an older corrupt cop says to a younger, not corrupt cop, the older cop says, it's a difficult job to be a policeman. And the younger cop says, a policeman's job is supposed to be difficult. Otherwise we have a police state. That's the whole point. And I mean, obviously that was lost on anyone else. Orson Welles, as usual, was ahead of his time. That was in 1958. But back to the 1970s, you also mentioned that at the same time we have another kind of narrative, which is the private investigator looking out for the little guy. And you gave the example of the Rockford Files.
So there is this countervailing narrative around really this larger question of injustice. And so I think while the police-centered shows are embracing this police-centered view of justice, there is this interesting counter-narrative in the 70s that I think is, you know, a holdover of some of the progressive elements of the 1970s, which says, you know, there are powerful people who are taking advantage of the little guy, and the system as normally constituted isn't really set up to do that. And this is really important to the current debate around abolition, which is people say, well, we need police to protect us from predators, but police don't actually protect us from the most rapacious predators in our lives. They don't protect us from environmental pollution. They don't protect us from climate change. They don't protect us from bosses who sexually harass us, steal our wages. And all of those harms are dramatically more impactful on our lives than street crime is. So in the 1970s, this kind of analysis takes the form of lionizing the private detective. And this was also a theme in the noir films of the 1930s, which was another area of progressive analysis about social problems that understood the limitations of policing and the traditional criminal legal system. And so these private detectives are able to go after people beyond just what the criminal law says and beyond what normal policing does. So they go after corrupt bosses. They go after sort of organized corporate criminality at times, not too often because that upsets the sponsors, but there is a little bit of this understanding that politicians are corrupt and business people are corrupt, and the little guy really doesn't have a chance in the face of that. And so they need a champion who operates outside that system.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, speaking of back to the noir era, yeah, that's in the noir era, you had the gumshoe detective who was the person's only hope, you know what I mean? They couldn't go to the cops, and even right down to a 70s movie, Chinatown, which is, again, about a PI who attempts to bust serious levels of corruption and basically environmental degradation, which is what's going on in the movie. But
one of my favorite movies, and one of the things, you know, it shows that you can just do a lot more with film than you can with television, right? So you can't have that same depth of critique of the system on television that you can in film. But, you know, Chinatown shows that what appears to be like crime is often just a product of these very powerful forces at work that are considered above the law by the police and courts.
And much has been written about the name of the movie itself, Chinatown, that it's kind of about what's not seen. You don't see Chinatown until the very end. It's just mentioned as this place that you don't go. And the whole movie is kind of about that. It's about the things that you're not supposed to talk about, including some very depraved moral situations as well.
And including what happened in his past, right? So there's this reference that he had been involved in something in Chinatown before and couldn't handle it. And now yet again, he's up against these powerful forces, which he knows what's right and what's wrong, but he lacks the institutional power to do anything about it.
And then there's the other, was made a little bit later, also reference to the noir gumshoe era, one of my favorite detective movies and a great movie about public transit and urban displacement. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Again, we have the gumshoe detective going up against these huge forces, which are trying to basically gentrify LA and get rid of the public transit. Another great movie.
And yeah, again, masquerading as a cartoon.
Yeah. Well, it's half cartoon, half real. And back to the 70s, Columbo is another private investigator. You know, Columbo is, again, the working class guy who's kind of a schmo, you know, walking around kind of out of it with his.
Now, he's a police detective, though.
Okay, he is.
Yeah, Columbo is a plainclothes police detective, unlike Rockford, you know, who is a private detective who had been wrongly incarcerated. So he spent time in jail. And, you know, the Rockford Files was created by Roy Huggins, who had been a kind of noir writer of that earlier 30s and 40s generation.
Interesting, because I was going to say Columbo, a lot of the times the perpetrator turns out to be a very rich person.
That's right.
So, I mean, we've still got that 70s kind of little guy versus the man thing. And then there's another narrative that I wanted to mention, and both of us grew up in the South, And I remember seeing a lot of these movies when I was a kid, which is there were often what we would call now independent films. One of the most famous was Billy Jack, where the cops are just outright thugs. And this is in the same period in the 70s, where the cops are just outright corrupt, violent thugs. It's often in the South. And the justice is done by a lone violent male, not by a social movement. So Billy Jack is one of the most famous, where he's a Marine veteran who's half Navajo, and he goes and saves this. There's like a hippie school out in New Mexico that's being terrorized by these cops. And actually the films of Burt Reynolds are an interesting trajectory, because they start with his movie White Lightning and the sequel Gator, where he goes to fight these cops who've killed his brother. And his brother was kind of a hippie and an activist, and his brother's friends, the other hippie activists, are portrayed as completely ineffectual. So it's Burt Reynolds, the tough guy, goes and beats up, kicks ass on the corrupt Southern sheriff and his henchmen. And he does, like I said, a sequel, Gator, and then there's other movies he does. But by the time we get to Smokey and the Bandit, 1977, the cops are outright buffoons. And then you get onto shows like Dukes of Hazzard or Sheriff Lobo, where the cops are just complete idiots. Again, this is television, but it's presaging, I feel like, this kind of Reagan era sort of comeback of what do they call it? Life affirming and definitely police affirming kind of reaction to that.
Well, Americans have always loved the outlaw hero, you know, Jesse James, in African American blues songs, you know, there are all these amazing outlaw heroes, and it's understood as a kind of form of resistance against the system, against the man. But the depth of the critique changes over time, and the understanding of the nature of policing changes under time. But it's one of the interesting contradictions of American culture, you know, this love of police, but also this love of the outlaw hero. One of my favorites being like Cool Hand Luke.
Right. So remind us about that. So he's in prison just for
he's in prison because he sawed the tops off the parking meters as an act of just like incoherent rage at society. And so he's just one of these people who can't live under the confines of a kind of oppressive, dehumanizing world. And so he lives true to himself, and this comes up against all these systems of control. And what better to show this than by using the chain gang, the Southern chain gang, as the setting for his acts of resistance, which ultimately, you know, result in his death.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I'd like to unpack in there. Yeah, first of all, there's the idea of the rebel. And I mean, there was even a book about George W. Bush called The Rebel in Chief. It's like there's somehow everybody wants to be a rebel, even when they're the president of the United States. There's a series of books called Rogue Warrior by a former Navy SEAL. He's talking about all the things he does. But again, he's a rogue. But they're still getting the job. They're still doing the same work, you know. I remember in one of those books, he talks about, you know, one of his friends who he met when he was on a Navy base somewhere, and how this guy was like filling all the orders without even filling out the paperwork. You know what I mean? Like right under his officer's nose, you know. But he's still doing his job. He's just doing his job his way. But he's still doing a job for the U.S. military. But somehow he's still a rebel. So somehow they always manage to twist that, even when it's even when they're doing the work of the state or of the system, they're somehow a rebel when they're doing it. And then there's, of course, you know, at the end of like you're saying, Cool Hand Luke and lots of other movies, where the rebel has to die. Can't quite, you know, that's kind of the end. It's the end of countless movies. Easy Rider to Thelma and Louise, you know, the rebellion can't be realized, the rebel has to die at the end.
Yeah, Thelma and Louise is a great example.
My name is Joe Roberts. I work for the state. I'm a sergeant out in Perrinville, barracks number 8. I've always done an honest job, honest as I could. Got a brother named Frankie. Frankie ain't no good.
Okay, so now we're past the 70s and we're into the 80s, but there's this odd case of the show Hill Street Blues, which is kind of a 70s show in the 80s. And it's kind of a unique cop show in retrospect, especially for that time period, because, you know, it's Hill Street Blues, which is a play on words like both the uniforms they wear, but then blues, like it's a sad, difficult job. And the theme music is a sad piano song. In every episode, you see the police leaving on a rainy dawn in some unnamed big city. It's a difficult job. You know, but we got to do it. Actors that they use look a lot more like actual civil servants. There was some kind of hat tip to trying to be at least a little bit realistic. And so what's your take on that show?
Well, I loved that show as a kid. I mean, I watched it very religiously. Because it had a kind of patina of urban realism. And I was always, you know, very much an urbanist, even as a kid, very much a city kid growing up in Houston, right in the central city. And it played out certain contradictions of, you know, crime is this problem that's harmful to the community, but police don't always have the solution. And there are, you know, root causes at work. They tried to, for instance, deal with youth violence by bringing the young people into the precinct and trying to organize gang truces. And so it wasn't all stick. It wasn't all punitive. But they also had a SWAT team. And there was this constant battle between should we send the SWAT team or should we go and talk to people, you know? And in the end, there is a kind of liberal realism that takes over, that says that, you know, we're going to talk as much as we can talk, but we need this big stick hanging over their head to get people to talk. So even though there's this kind of liberal idea about root causes, it's still very much a legitimation of a police-centered strategy. And there's rarely this idea of, oh, we could try to solve problems outside of these questions of policing, like why are our cities such a mess in the 1980s? Where's the discussion about white flight, deindustrialization, defunding of local governments by the federal government? You know, those questions never really make it into the conversation.
Well, Frankie went into the army back in 1965, I got a farm deferment, settled down, took Maria for my wife. But them wheat prices kept on dropping till it was like we's getting robbed. Frankie came home in 68. Me, I took this job.
I think there's an excellent example of the sea change that was taking place in the 80s, because in the beginning, the early Hill Street Blues, each show would start with a roll call in the morning and the sergeant would end with saying, hey, let's be careful out there. Okay, it's dangerous. Let's be careful. That's what he's worried about everyone. Well, then that actor died and they replaced him with someone else who would say the same thing. And then later in the show, they bring on a different actor who does the roll call. And his line at the beginning of each show is, let's go out there and do it to them before they do it to us. It's like, now it's like, get out. Now it's kill or be killed. And
it's,
I think
so, that, it's so common with shows that have a long life to see them become more and more identified with the police, so that the nuances, the contradictions sort of fall away. I'll give you another good example of this is Hawaii Five-O, which also begins in the 1960s and starts, yes, it's very police-centered, but there is this kind of community connectedness that is evoked in the early episodes, this sort of sense where the police don't really need to be involved in every problem, and maybe we can use our discretion to look the other way sometimes, and we can be sympathetic to the plight of people. But by the end of the series, it's just 100% pro-cop propaganda. Cops can never do anything wrong. Everyone who commits a crime is a super villain who there's no excuse. They just need to be erased.
I mean, I agree that, I mean, one of my favorite writers, Richard Price, that's one of my, probably my biggest complaint with him is he spends a lot of time with the cops. And so he really captures the vernacular and the day-to-day work, but it's ultimately, you know, sympathetic to them.
Same problem with journalists, right? That they identify with the police. Police are the official source. There's always a police press person you can call. The police invite them for ride-alongs, you know, and so they see the world through the eyes of the police, and they never have that same level engagement with communities, with nonprofits, churches, tenants associate, you know, they never become embedded in those worlds in the same way. And so they just report things basically based on what the police tell them.
Yeah. It's also similar with the war correspondents. You know, they may very well go over to whatever the U.S. conflict is. They may go over there with their criticisms, et cetera. And then, but spending lots of time with the troops and with the soldiers, you begin to see the world through that lens, you know, and unless the journalist really makes the effort to get outside of that world, you know, that's the world you're going to be portraying. Yeah, so we talked about the 80s, and there's a sea change, and it begins to be more about trust the police, and you know, with the whole sort of 80s Reagan revolution and cop shows. But let's move on to the 90s and more recent times. We have shows like CSI, Law and Order. I'd like to hear your take on those.
Well, CSI has been really influential. You know, lots of spin-offs, incredibly popular, and has had real impacts on the criminal legal system, the so-called CSI effect. So the problem here, right, is that, and it's not just CSI, it's also Bones and some of these other forensic-oriented shows, they all rest on this premise that we can use science and technology to fight crime. Whether it's predictive policing or finding a little paint chip that goes to a car that leads to some person that we never imagined, whatever. So all these shows imagine that we can use these discrete bits of evidence to find some person and prove that they did it. When in fact, the way this operates is completely the opposite. In the vast majority of cases, police have the person that they believe did it. And then they try to collect some evidence to be able to provide enough proof that this person will plead guilty and that a trial won't be necessary. So they own like matching paint chips or fibers or hair, or even often things like fingerprints and DNA. It only works if you already have the person in custody. You already have a search warrant for their home. You know, you have access to their clothing, right? Because you already know who did it. And how do you know who did it? Well, either you find them at the scene or someone tells the police who did it. It's not because they found some paint chip or hair fiber. But now people think if we just give police enough technology, they'll be able to find the bad guys. And this, of course, again, assumes that the bad guys are predators who commit street crime, when in fact the bad guys are bosses who steal our wages and corporate executives who pollute the environment, none of which gets resolved by any of this stuff. Law and Order, which begins earlier, is just, you know, a classic form of criminal legal proceduralism. You know, police follow leads, find the unexpected bad guy, and then prosecutors, you know, marshal the evidence as best they can. Now, Law and Order was, I think, entertaining because it contained within it certain contradictions. You know, at the end of the prosecution, there were times where it's not really clear that justice was done, because there was a little bit of an understanding that the law is not exactly nuanced enough, the criminal law, to handle these things, and that really we need some other tools. But by the time you get, like with all these shows, right, over time they become less nuanced, more conservative. By the time you get to SVU, which is the one that has sort of run the longest, a lot of that nuance goes out the window, and it's much more about supervillains in the sense, you know, of completely unredeemable people, and everything is a lot more black and white, so to speak.
Right. You mentioned the CSI effect. What exactly is that?
Oh, I'm sorry. So the CSI effect is being experienced in courts where juries want to see evidence that they're used to seeing on nightly television. So they're like, well, where's the fibers that link the person? Where's the laser pointer trajectories of each of the 37 bullets? You know, like they want this level of scientific proof that doesn't actually exist, that most of the technology in the CSI series, no police departments actually have that technology. Sometimes it exists in theory. Or yes, there's a lab somewhere that can do that, but the vast majority of police departments don't have access to that kind of equipment, and it doesn't really do what CSI claims it does.
One example of that is they often use a mass spectrometer, and I happen to know a guy who's a scientist, and mass spectrometers are really expensive. If you're lucky, there's one in a university in your town. But he's like, when he watches that show, he's like, they find a hair and they put it in the mass spec and it has the guy's address on it. And it's like, you would have to wait. You would probably have to get special permission. You know, they don't have a mass spectrometer in the Tulsa, Oklahoma Police Department basement. You know, this is a huge.
These labs are terrible. They work for the police department, so they have a built-in bias. We have tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of untested rape kits in the United States. We have constant scandals of faked test results, of fake science like bite mark, you know, identification to get serial killers. And this stuff is just made up. Right. DNA has definitely some powerful effects, but of course, it's still being utilized in this context that says that crime is this very limited set of, you know, street crime type harms that are to be resolved by finding the bad people and putting them in prison. So even if we accept, you know, the utility of DNA, this is not the best strategy for protecting women, for reducing death, you know, premature deaths, we have so many other strategies we could be using other than that to create real safety and real justice.
I got a star on my car and one on my chest, a gun on my hip and the right to arrest. I am the guy who's the boss on this highway, so watch out what you're doing when you're driving my way. If you break the law, you'll hear from me. I know I'm working for the state. I'm the highway patrol.
And I don't think it's possible to talk about the 1990s and police on television without talking about the long-standing show Cops, who recently completed 20 years on the air.
It's been amazing. So Cops kind of takes police proceduralism to a whole new level. I think one of the most important things to remember is that Cops is essentially co-produced by police departments. Was run on Fox, right, the most conservative network, as just pure cop propaganda. So the way it works, right, is the producers go to local police departments and they have to get the permission of the local police department to do these ride-alongs and film them. And included in this permission is the right of the police department in most cases to review things before they go on the air. And so there's direct censorship of what goes on the air. And indirectly, there's an even higher level of censorship, because if the producers of Cops showed an act of corruption or brutality or, you know, racist harassment that got a police department into trouble, then no other police department will ever agree to work with them. So they self-censor themselves, knowing that the show will only be allowed to run, will only be capable of running, if it has the direct approval of local police departments.
You had turned me on to this, to the podcast called Running from Cops, which I highly recommend to the listeners, and I'll include a link on the page, because they do an excellent job of breaking down that show, and very, very thorough and actually very respectful as well.
Yeah, they just show how cases are made up against people. People's lives are ruined because some cop said they did something that turns out not to be the case. And this is, you know, also true of the show Live PD. And I think one of the most striking and remarkable accomplishments of last summer's protests was the cancellation of those shows.
I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know that. They were canceled?
Shows were canceled last summer.
Wow. Well, it took long enough. And I think we should chalk that up to as a success on the part of the movement.
Dick, man, there goes Mac the Knife.
And Alex, I know you'd wanted to talk about this new show called The Defeated, which takes place in Berlin in 1946, right after World War II. Berlin is in shambles, and a tough New York City cop has been sent there to help them reform or modernize their police department.
Yeah, this has just come out on Netflix, and it's just a classic example of copaganda. The idea that the problems of Berlin were problems of crime that could be solved by professional, community-embedded, you know, policing. So they have the precinct that he's sent to is run by a woman, has a 16-year-old Jewish kid whose family were police before, you know, the Nazis came to power, and they're connected to the community, and the bad guy is this sort of supervillain. And what we need is, you know, effective, professional, community-oriented policing, and that's going to fix the problem. And of course, the bad guy is trading in black market goods. is involved in the sex work trade, right? Prostitution, et cetera, including forced prostitution. And the idea that the solution to Berlin's problems in 1946 are more intensive professional policing is just ridiculous. What they needed was food and jobs and resources and possibly things like the legalization or decriminalization of sex work as a just an acknowledgement of the desperate circumstances that people were in and the need to bring that activity out from under, you know, this hidden black market world that where it's controlled by organized criminality. And so, you know, this is really what it's in part saying is, oh, American policing was so awesome that it saves Berlin. And there's a long history of this. The police reform as carried out in waves during the 20th century is often done in relationship to guys who served in American military policing functions. So you've got August Vollmer, who was part of the U.S. occupation of the Philippines after the Spanish-American War, who brings colonial counterinsurgency techniques from the Philippines to American policing. Then you have O.W. Wilson, who was part of the Reconstruction forces in Japan after the war and military policing. And then he brings that technology back to American policing. And so my friend Stuart Schrader, in his book Badges Beyond Borders, Badges Without Borders, shows this constant interplay between domestic policing and U.S. foreign policy. And this show embodies the kind of propaganda about that that's completely uncritical about the U.S. role in perpetuating some of the worst conditions in Germany after the war.
Yeah, you're pointing to something very important, Alex, the back and forth between the military and the police in the United States. I remember being at seeing some live music in San Francisco one time, and I happened to stand next to a guy who was wearing a t-shirt of the Army Rangers, a kind of elite force. And I started talking to him, and he had indeed been in the Rangers. And he said he was helping train the Hayward Police Force in some capacity. Hayward's this suburb in the Bay Area. And they have this special forces guy training the cops for some reason.
And it just shows the connection. You know, we were talking before a little bit about Afghanistan and even Vietnam, right? But these things are ideologically linked, right? Around a kind of neoconservatism that says that our problems, whether it's around the world or domestically, are not rooted in the deep inequalities of capitalism, of imperialism, of racism that is interlinked with those processes. No, our problems are evil terrorists, evil criminals, and the way we deal with those problems is through violence, coercion, threats, whether it's military intervention or intensive policing and mass incarceration and the death penalty and all that. And these people proposing these ideas are often the same people. You know, what's good overseas is good at home. And to say after like 20 years of complete failure in Afghanistan that, you know, we should have kept the permanent war going is just the deepest kind of inhumanity. And yet this is treated as serious discourse on the television and newspapers and all the rest. But it's the same thing with crime discourse. So that while you have these people who are like, well, we have to have war because they're bad people. Well, we have to have police because they're bad people. And so you get these police apologists like Matt Iglesias who like, well, we can't possibly defund the police because police are the only tool we have to get these bad people who commit violence, right? And so just immediately assuming the only possible strategy available to address problems of interpersonal harm are policing, when we know that it just doesn't work very well. and leaves lots of harms unaddressed. But they're rooted in the same ideology. Well, we can't leave Afghanistan because then, you know, women will be vulnerable to the Taliban. So they're saying, oh, we have to keep killing thousands and thousands, if not tens of thousands of people, because that's how we keep women safe. If they gave two shits about the well-being of women, we would have open borders. And we would just say, any woman fearing prosecution will take you. If it's 10,000, if it's 100,000, if it's 250,000, just keep coming, because we actually want to help women. But even if they come here as women, they won't be protected, right? They'll be subjected to sexual harassment, poverty conditions, low wages, wage theft, resistance to organizing, no child care supports, inadequate health care. So this discourse that we have to keep engaging in mass death or mass policing because it's protecting women is just the most outrageous hypocrisy.
Part of the World War II myth is that the United States went over there to save the Jews, when the fact of the matter is the people running society and running the war did not care at all. If they had, then famously that passenger ship that went up and down the East Coast of the United States, it was all people, majority of them were Jewish, who were threatened with being killed by the Nazis, and no one would let them land anywhere from Florida to Maine. And they had to go back, and 2/3 of them were killed. They sent them back to Europe. So I wanted to start winding it up here, our discussion about police as portrayed in popular culture in the United States. And one way I thought of looking at it, I think overall, is this. If you have a show or a novel or a movie in which police are central characters, and especially if they are sympathetic central characters, and you don't incorporate into that story somehow what police actually do, and what they are actually there for, and what sort of social effects their work has, then as far as I'm concerned, the story in question is ultimately reactionary, or at least partly so. I mean, if you don't bring that in somehow, like I was saying, I love Richard Price, but
it's propaganda.
It's propaganda. But I wanted to go to a ending conclusion. So what do you think this means for society, the way police and law enforcement are portrayed? I think you sort of answered that, but what do you think it means for society, the way police and law enforcement are portrayed, the way crime is portrayed? And what do you see as a way forward? What would you say to Hollywood producers and independent filmmakers about how they portray police and crime in their shows and their movies?
Well, look, Hollywood has always been a propaganda machine. The big studio heads, the big financiers of television and movies, have interests. And this is reflected in what gets greenlit. So we need to look to independent sources. And we need to challenge, creators to move beyond these simplistic narratives that take on a police-centered worldview. Yeah, policing is easy to choose as a subject of drama because we can see lots of social conflicts play out through the role of policing, but we need other settings for those dramas. Let's get back into the community. Let's get back into the lives of real people, and let's bring some class and race analysis into all of this. Communities are hurting. And one expression of that is crime, as we normally think about it. But these communities are also experiencing suicides, overdoses, and all the effects of poverty on reduced life expectancy and the inner turmoil, right? And so where is the examination of that? Where is the examination of the mobilization of communities to try to resolve these problems, whether it's forming a union or creating a community-based anti-violence group? Like, those real struggles are very dramatic. But somehow, you know, there is never, ever any kind of portrayal of people struggling for their rights at work. Unions don't exist in our popular culture. They have been canceled. Well, let's bring some of that back. You know, let's talk about working people struggling to try to make their lives better collectively and the forces that are arrayed against them, including the police.
And that'll do it for this episode of Hammer and Tongs. Thanks again to our guest, Alex Vitale. Look for links and information about the music we played on the show on the page, and we hope to talk again.